After passing through infinite frontier, the droplet continued onward at a speed of 30 kilometers per second. In the space of 3 seconds, it had crossed 90 kilometers, passing first through Yuan Fang, infinite frontier's neighbour in the first row, and then through Foghorn, Antarctica, and Ultimate, leaving their hulls red hot, as if the warships were giant lamps lined up. Then Infinite Frontier exploded. It and the 4 warships after it were hit in the fusion fuel tanks. But unlike Mantis's conventional high-temperature explosion, this explosion was a fusion reaction triggered in Infinite Frontier's fuel. No one ever figured out whether the fusion reaction had been sparked by the droplet's ultra-high-temperature propulsive halo or some other factor. The fireball of the thermonuclear explosion appeared at the point of impact with the fuel tank and swiftly expanded until it illuminated the entire fleet against the velvety background of space, outshining the Milky Way. Nuclear fireballs then took shape on Yuan Fang, Foghorn, Antarctica, and Ultimate in succession. In the next 8 seconds, the droplet passed through 10 more Stellar-class warships. By this point, the expanding nuclear fireball had engulfed the entirety of Infinite Frontier and had begun to shrink, while more fireballs were lighting up and expanding on other ships that had been struck. The droplet continued to traverse the length of the array, penetrating one Stellar-class warship after another at intervals of less than a second. The fusion fireball on Infinite Frontier had gone out, leaving the ship's hull totally melted. Now it exploded, spewing 1 million tons of glowing, dark red metallic liquid, like a bud bursting into bloom, the molten metal scattering unimpeded in an omnidirectional storm of burning metallic magma. The droplet continued its advance, following a straight line through more warships and leaving a line of 10 nuclear fireballs behind it. The entire fleet shone in the flames of these burning small suns as if it had been set ablaze and turned into a sea of light. Behind the line of fireballs, the melted warships continued to fling waves of hot molten metal into space as if massive rocks were being pitched into a magma sea. In 1 minute and 18 seconds, the droplet had completed a 2,000-kilometer course, passing through each of the 100 ships in the first row of the combined fleet's rectangular formation. By the time the last ship in the row, Adam, was swallowed up in a nuclear fireball, the bursts of metallic magma at the opposite end had scattered, cooled, and spread out, leaving the heart of the explosion, the spot where Infinite Frontier had been a minute before, empty of practically everything. Yuan Feng, Foghorn, Antarctica, Ultimate, all of them vanished one after another into metallic magma. When the last nuclear fireball in the line went out and darkness fell upon space once more, the gradually cooling magma that had barely been visible reappeared as dark red lights in the blackness of space, like a 2,000-kilometer-long river of blood. After punching through Adam, the droplet flew a short distance of about 80 kilometers through empty space, then executed another sharp turn, unexplainable by humanity's aerospace mechanics. This time, the angle it described was even smaller, just 15 degrees off a total reversal, executed nearly instantaneously, even as it maintained a constant speed. Then, after a small heading adjustment that brought it in line with the second row of warships in the fleet's array, or what was now the first row in light of the recent destruction, it sped toward the first ship in that row, Ganges, at 30 kilometers per second. Until this point, Fleet Command had not made any response. The fleet's battle information system had faithfully carried out its mission and captured through its massive monitoring network a complete record of all battle information over the course of that 1 minute and 18 seconds. The sheer amount of information was, for the time being, only analysable by the computerised battlefield decision-making system, which had arrived at the following conclusion. A powerful enemy space force had appeared in the vicinity and had launched an attack on the fleet. However, the computer did not provide any information about that enemy force. Only two things were certain. One, the enemy space force was located at the position occupied by the droplet, and two, the force was invisible to every means of detection they possessed. By this time, fleet commanders were in a state of numb shock. For nearly two centuries, research into space strategy and tactics had dreamed up every possible kind of extreme battle condition, but witnessing 100 warships blowing up like a string of firecrackers in under a minute was beyond what their minds could comprehend. The tide of information surging out of the battle information system meant that they were forced to rely on the analysis and judgments of the computer battlefield decision-making system and focus their attention on detecting an invisible enemy fleet that didn't even exist. All battle monitoring capacity was directed into the distant regions of space, ignoring the danger right in front of them. A fair number of people even believed that the powerful invisible enemy might be a third-party alien force distinct from humanity and Trisolaris, because in their subconscious minds, Trisolaris remained the weaker, losing side. The fleet's battle monitoring system did not detect the droplet's presence any earlier, primarily because it was invisible to radar at all wavelengths and could only be located through analysis of visible spectrum images. But visible images were treated with far less importance than radar data. Most of the fragments scattered through space in storms of exploded debris were liquid metal melted by the high-temperature nuclear blasts, upward of 1 million tons melted in the destruction of each ship. A fair proportion of this massive amount of molten debris was roughly the same size and shape as the droplet, which presented the computer image analysis system with the difficult task of distinguishing the droplet from the debris. Besides, practically all of the commanders believed that the droplet had self-destructed inside Mantis, so no one issued specific instructions to perform such an analysis. Meanwhile, other circumstances were exacerbating the confusion of battle. Debris ejected from the explosions of the first row of warships soon reached the second row, prompting their battle defence systems to respond with high-energy lasers and railguns to intercept the debris. These flying fragments, consisting largely of metal melted by the nuclear fireballs, were irregular in size, and although they had been partially cooled in flight by the low temperatures of space, only their outer shells had solidified. Their insides were still in a fiery liquid state, and when struck, they scattered in a brilliant explosion of fireworks. It was not long before the second row turned into a flaming barrier parallel to the dull river of blood left behind by the exploded warships in the first, roiling with explosions as if washed in a tide of fire surging from the direction of that invisible enemy. Debris flew thick as hail, more than defensive systems could block, and when fragments slipped through and struck the warships, the impact of these jets of solid liquid metal possessed considerable destructive power. A number of the ships in the fleet's second row suffered major hull damage, and some were even punctured. Shrill decompression alarms blared. Although the dazzling battle with debris did receive notice, given the circumstances, it was hard for the computers and humans in the command system to avoid the misconception that the fleet was engaged in a fierce exchange of fire with an enemy space force. Neither person nor machine noticed the tiny figure of death that had begun to destroy the second row of ships. And so, When the droplet charged at Ganges, the 100 warships in the second row were still assembled in a straight line, a death formation. The droplet surged like lightning, and in the space of just 10 seconds it passed through 12 warships. Ganges, Columbia, Justice, Masada, Proton, Yandi, Atlantic, Sirius, Thanksgiving, Advance, Han, and Tempest. As in the destruction of the first row, each warship turned red-hot after penetration, before being engulfed in a nuclear fireball that left 1 million tons of dark red glowing metallic magma that then exploded. In this brutal destruction, the lined-up warships were like a 2,000-kilometer fuse that burned with such intensity that it left behind nothing but ash glowing a dull, dark red. 1 minute and 21 seconds later, the 100 ships in the second row had been completely annihilated. After passing through the last ship, Meiji, the droplet reached the end of the row and turned another acute angle to charge straight at the first ship in the third row, Newton. During the destruction of the second row, debris from the explosions had raged into the third. The tide of debris included molten metal flung from explosions in the second row, as well as mostly cooled metal fragments from the ships in the first. Most of the third row ships had by now started up their engines and defensive systems and had begun manoeuvring, which meant that this time the ships were not situated along a perfectly straight line, as had been the case for the first and second rows. Nevertheless, the 100 ships were still roughly in line. After the droplet passed through Newton, it sharply adjusted direction and in a twinkling crossed the 20 kilometres separating Newton from Enlightenment, now at a 3 kilometer offset from the line. From Enlightenment, it turned sharply again, raced towards Cretaceous, which was moving toward the other side, and penetrated it. Following this broken path, the droplet drilled through the ships in the third row one after the other, never dropping its speed below 30 kilometers per second. When analysts subsequently observed the droplet's route, they were amazed to discover that its every turn was a sharp corner, not the smooth curve of a human spacecraft. The diabolical flight path demonstrated a space drive entirely beyond human comprehension, as if the droplet was a shadow without mass, unconcerned with the principles of dynamics, moving at will like the nib of God's pen. During the attack on the fleet's third row, the droplet's sharp changes of direction occurred at a rate of 2 or 3 per second, a deathly embroidery needle sewing a thread of destruction through the row's 100 ships. The droplet took 2 minutes and 35 seconds to destroy the third row of ships. By this time, all of the warships in the fleet had started their engines. Although the array had lost its shape entirely, the droplet continued to strike the evacuating ships. The pace of destruction slowed, but at any given time, 3 to 5 nuclear fireballs were burning among the ships. Their deathly flames drowned out the glow of the engines, turning them into a cluster of terrified fireflies. The fleet command system still had no clue about the true source of the attack and continued to focus its energies on searching for the imaginary invisible enemy fleet. However, subsequent analysis of the massive clouds of vague information transmitted by the fleet revealed that it was at this point that the earliest analysis to come close to the truth was performed by 2 low-ranking officers in the Asian fleet. One was Ensign Zhao Xin, an assistant targeting screener on Bei Feng, and the other was Captain Li Wei, an intermediate EM weapons system controller on Wan Nian Kun Peng. A transcript of their conversation follows. Zhao Xin: "This is Bei Feng TR-317 calling Wan Nian Kun Peng, EM986. This is Beifeng TR317 calling Wanyan Kunpeng, EM986. Li Wei. This is Wanyan Kunpeng, EM986. Please be advised, transmitting ship-to-ship voice communication at this information level is a violation of wartime regulations. Zhao Xin. Is that Li Wei? This is Zhao Xin. You're who I'm trying to find. Li Wei. Hi. I'm glad to know you're still alive. Zhao Xin. Captain, here's the thing. I've discovered something that I'd like to transmit to the shared command level, but my privileges are too low. Could you help me out? Li Wei. My privileges are too low too, but shared command has plenty of information right now. What do you want to transmit? Zhao Xin. I've analysed a visual image of the battle. Li Wei. Shouldn't you be analysing radar information? Zhao Xin. That's a system fallacy. When I analysed the visual image and extracted only the speed characteristic, do you know what I found? Do you know what's been going on? Li Wei. You seem to know. Zhao Xin. Don't think I've gone crazy. You know me, we're friends. Li Wei. You're a stone-cold beast. You'll be the last to go crazy. Go ahead. Zhao Xin. Listen, it's the fleet that's gone crazy. We're attacking ourselves. Li Wei. Zhao Xin. Infinite Frontier attacked Yuan Feng, and Yuan Feng attacked Foghorn, and Foghorn attacked Antarctica, and Antarctica, Li Wei, you're out of your damn mind, Zhao Xin. That's what's happening. A attacks B, and after B is attacked, but before it explodes, it attacks C. And after C is attacked, but before it explodes, it attacks D. It's like every warship that was hit attacked the next warship in the row. Like an infection, damn it, or a game of pass the parcel, but to the death. It's insane. Li Wei. What weapons are they using? Zhao Xin. I don't know. I picked up a projectile in the image, so frickin' tiny and so frickin' fast, way the hell faster than your rail guns, and incredibly precise. It hit the fuel tanks every single time. Li Wei. Send me the analysis. Zhao Xin. I've sent it over. The original data and vector analysis both. Take a look, goddammit. Ensign Zhao Xin's analysis, though unconventional, was pretty close to the truth. Li Wei took half a minute to study the information he sent over. In that time, another 39 warships were destroyed. Li Wei, I've noticed something about the speed. Zhao Xin, what speed? Li Wei, the speed of the small projectile. Its speed, when it's launched from each warship, is slightly slower. Then it accelerates to 30 kilometers per second during flight. Then it strikes the next warship, and when it launches from that warship prior to the explosion, its speed is a little slower. Then it accelerates. Zhao Xin, that doesn't mean anything. Li Wei, what I mean is, it's a little like drag. Zhao Xin, drag? How so? Li Wei, every time this projectile passes through a target, the drag slows it down. Zhao Xin, I see what you're doing. I'm not stupid. You said this projectile and passes through a target. Is it a single object? Li Wei, take a look outside. Another 100 ships have exploded. This conversation took place not in the modern language of the fleet, but in 21st century Mandarin. From the mode of speech, it was obvious that the two were hibernators. There were few hibernators serving in the fleet, and although most of them had awakened while still very young, they still lacked a modern person's capacity to absorb information, which meant that most of them carried out relatively low-level duties. It was later discovered that the vast majority of officers and soldiers who recovered their senses and good judgment the earliest during the Grand Destruction were hibernators. These two officers, for instance, despite being at a level that did not even permit them the use of the ship's advanced systems, were nonetheless able to perform a remarkable piece of analysis. Zhao Xin and Li Wei's information was not passed up the fleet command system, but the system's analysis of the battle was headed in the right direction. Realizing that the invisible enemy force posited by the computer decision-making system didn't exist, attention was now focused on analyzing the aggregated battle information. After a search and match on massive amounts of data, the system finally discovered the continued existence of the droplet. The image of the droplet extracted from battle recordings was unchanged, apart from the addition of a propulsion halo at the tail. It was still a perfect droplet shape, only this time what was reflected as it sped onward was the glow of nuclear fireballs and metal magma, glaring brightness alternating with dark red. It looked like a drop of burning blood. Further analysis arrived at a model of the droplet's attack path. Various scenarios for the Doomsday Battle had been concocted during 2 centuries of the study of space strategy, but in the minds of strategists, the enemy had always been big. Humanity would meet the main part of the mighty Trisolaran force on a space battlefield, with every warship a fortress of death the size of a small city. They had imagined every extreme form of weapons and tactics the enemy could possibly possess, the most terrifying of which involved the Trisolaran fleet launching an attack using antimatter weapons and obliterating a stellar-class battleship with antimatter the size of a rifle bullet. But now, the combined fleet had to face facts. Their only enemy was a tiny probe, one drop of water out of the enormous ocean of Trisolaran strength, and this probe attacked using one of the oldest and most primitive tactics known to human navies, ramming. Roughly 13 minutes passed from the moment the probe started its attack until the fleet command system arrived at the correct assessment. Given the complex and grim battlefield conditions, this was fairly quick, but the droplet was quicker. In 20th century naval battles, there might have been time for commanders to be summoned to the flagship for a conference once the enemy fleet appeared on the horizon, but space battles were measured in seconds, and in that 13-minute span, more than 600 warships were destroyed by the probe. Only then did humanity realize that command of a space battle was beyond their reach, and due to the Sophon block, it was beyond the reach of their artificial intelligence as well. Purely in terms of command, humanity might never have the capacity to engage in a space battle with Trisolaris. The speed of the droplet's strikes and its invisibility to radar meant that the defensive systems on the first ship's hit never responded. But as the distance between the warships grew and the droplet's striking distance increased, defensive systems on all warships were recalibrated based on the droplet's target characteristics. This meant that Nelson was the first ship to attempt to intercept, using laser weapons to increase the accuracy of firing on the small, high-speed target. When struck by the multiple beams, the droplet emitted a powerful visible light, even though the Nelson had fired gamma-ray lasers that were invisible to the naked eye. The droplet's imperceptibility to radar had never been understood, since it had a completely reflective surface and a shape that was perfectly diffuse. But perhaps the ability to alter the frequency of reflected electromagnetic waves was the secret to its invisibility. The light emitted from the droplet when it was struck was so bright it drowned out the nuclear fireballs going off all around it, forced the monitoring systems to dim their images to avoid damage to their optical components, and caused sustained blindness to anyone who looked directly at it. In other words, this super-powerful light was indistinguishable from darkness in its effect. The droplet, wrapped in this all-engulfing light, entered Nelson and was extinguished, plunging the battlefield into pitch darkness. Moments later, the nuclear fireballs re-established their dominance, and the droplet emerged from Nelson unscathed and sped straight for Green, 80-odd kilometres away. Green's defence system switched over to EM-based kinetic weapons to intercept the attacking droplet. The metal shells fired by the railgun possessed enormous destructive power, and the kinetic energy inherent in their high speed meant that every shell that struck the target hit with the force of a bomb. Against ground targets, they would flatten a mountain in no time at all. The droplet's relative velocity only added to the shell's energy, but when they struck, the droplet slowed only slightly before it adjusted its propulsion and recovered its speed. Under a dense hail of shells, it flew straight at Green and penetrated it. Under the ultra-high magnification microscope, the droplet's surface would still be mirror-smooth and totally scratch-free. Strong interaction materials differs from ordinary matter, like solid differs from liquid. The attacks on the droplet by human weapons were like waves striking a reef. Damaging it was impossible, which meant that nothing in the solar system could destroy it. It was untouchable. The fleet command system had just stabilized itself, only to be plunged once again into chaos. This time, its despair over the loss of every weapon available to it meant it would not recover from this collapse. The merciless slaughter in space continued. As the distance between ships grew, the droplet accelerated and had soon doubled its speed to 60 kilometers per second, exhibiting a cool and precise intelligence in its continuous attacks. It solved the travelling salesman problem in local regions with perfect accuracy, hardly ever retracing its path. With its targets in constant motion, the droplet accomplished a huge range of accurate measurements and complex calculations effortlessly and at high speed. In the course of its intensely focused massacre, it would occasionally veer off to the edges of the group of ships to quickly dispatch a few outliers and arrest the fleet's inclination to flee in that direction. The droplet usually made precise strikes on the ship's fuel tanks, whether it found them by real-time location detection or with the use of a stored database of every ship's structure provided by the Sophons was unknown. However, in around 10% of the targets, the droplet did not strike the tanks. The destruction of those ships did not involve fusion in the nuclear material, so it took a comparatively long time for the red-hot ships to finally explode, a brutal situation in which the crew suffered under high temperatures before burning to death. The evacuation of the ships did not go smoothly. It was too late to enter deep sea state, so the warships could only evacuate at a head 3 acceleration, which made scattering impossible. Like a sheepdog racing alongside a flock, the droplet executed occasional blocking strikes at different positions at the fleet's edges to keep it in shape. Space was full of cooled or still molten debris and large chunks of warships, so ship defence systems had to continually sweep their flight path with lasers or railguns. The fragments formed glittering, flaming arcs that wrapped each ship in a brilliant canopy. Yet some debris still slipped through the defences and caused serious hull damage and even loss of navigational capability when they struck the ships directly. Collision with larger fragments was fatal. Despite the collapse of the fleet command system, High Command remained in charge during evacuation, but the density of the initial formation meant collisions between ships were unavoidable. Himalaya and Thor collided head-on at high speed and were smashed to bits. Messenger rear-ended Genesis, and the air that leaked like a hurricane through the gashes tore into both ships and blew personnel and other objects out into space, forming tails that dragged along in the wake of the two giant wrecks. Most horrifying of all was what happened to Einstein and Xia, whose captains bypassed system protections via remote control mode and entered a head-4 acceleration. None of their personnel was protected by deep-sea state. Images transmitted from Xia showed a hangar emptied of fighters, but occupied by over 100 people who were flattened against the deck by the high Gs once acceleration began. From this vantage point, observers saw crimson flowers of blood bloom on the white space the size of a football field, forming extremely thin layers that spread out and ultimately merged into one under the immense force. Spherical cabins presented the ultimate horror. At the beginning of hypergravitation, everyone inside slid to the bottom, and then the devil's weighty hands squished them all into a lump, as if balling up a pile of clay men, with no time for anyone to even scream. The only sound was of shattering bones and viscera squeezing out. Then the pile of flesh and bones was submerged in a bloody liquid that turned eerily clear once the solids were precipitated out by the high Gs, its surface flat and motionless as a mirror under the intense force. It seemed solid, and the formless pile of flesh, bone and organs lay within it like rubies sealed in crystal. Afterward, the people initially thought that putting Einstein and Xia into a head-4 had been a mistake during the chaos, but further analysis repudiated this view. Using the remote control mode to bypass the stringent procedures required by the warship control system prior to executing a head-4 acceleration, including the confirmation that all personnel were in deep-sea state, involved a complicated series of operations that were unlikely to have been made in error. In the information transmitted from the two ships, it was also found that, prior to entering a head-4, Einstein and Xia had been using fighters and smaller craft to transport personnel outside. They did not enter a head-4 until the droplet drew nearer and neighbouring warships began to explode. This suggested that they intended to escape the droplet at top acceleration to preserve humanity's warships, but even Einstein and Xia were unable to evade the droplet's clutches. The keen-eyed death god noticed that two ships were accelerating far faster than the average rate of the group and swiftly caught up to them and destroyed the ships and their lifeless cargo. But two other warships successfully accelerated at a head-4 and escaped the droplet's attack. Quantum and Bronze Age, which had both entered deep-sea state prior to the battle at Ding Yi's behest. As soon as the third row of ships had been destroyed, the two of them entered a head-4 and made an emergency escape in the same direction. Their position in a corner of the array, with the entire fleet separating them from the droplet, gave them sufficient time to escape into the depths of space. More than 1,000 ships, over half the fleet, had been destroyed in a 20-minute attack. Space was chock-full of debris in a cluster 10,000 kilometers in diameter, a rapidly expanding metallic cloud whose edges were illuminated time and again by the nuclear fireballs of exploding warships, as if a giant, stony face were flickering in and out of the cosmic night. In between the fireballs, the glow of metallic magma turned the cloud into a blood-red sunset. The remaining warships were scattered widely, but nearly all of them were still within the metallic cloud. The majority had exhausted their railguns and had to rely on lasers to open up a path through the cloud, but the energy drain made the lasers underpowered and left the ships to wend a slow, tortuous path through the debris. Most of them moved at a speed practically the same as the cloud's rate of expansion, turning it into a death trap from which evacuation and flight were impossible. The droplet's speed was now 10 times the third cosmic velocity, or roughly 170 kilometers per second. Its course took it smashing through the debris that liquefied under impact, splashing away at high speed to collide with other debris and giving the droplet a brilliant tail. First, it resembled a comet bristling with rage, but as the tail lengthened, it turned into a huge silver dragon that stretched 10,000 kilometres. The entire metallic cloud glowed with the dragon's light as it whipped to and fro in its mad dance. The warships penetrated by the dragon's head began to explode along its body, so that it was dotted with the nuclear explosions of 4 or 5 small suns at any given time. Further back, molten battleships became million-ton metallic magma explosions that dyed its tail a bewitching blood red. The brilliant dragon was still flying 30 minutes later, but the nuclear fireballs on its body had disappeared, and its tail was no longer blood red. Not a single warship remained in the metallic cloud. When the dragon flew out of the cloud, its body vanished at the cloud's edge, its head followed by its tail. Then it began taking out the remnants of the fleet. Only 21 warships had cleared the cloud, most of them suffering enough damage in the process that they retained minimal acceleration or were even coasting unpowered. These were quickly caught and destroyed by the droplet. The metallic clouds formed from the newly exploded ships expanded and merged into the larger cloud. The droplet had to spend a bit more time destroying the 5 mostly intact ships, because they had already picked up speed and were headed in different directions. The final ship to be destroyed, Ark, had travelled a considerable distance from the cloud, so when the fireball of its explosion lit up space for a few seconds before going out, it was like a solitary lamp in the wind of the wilderness. Humanity's space-based armed forces had been annihilated. The droplet briefly accelerated in the direction Quantum and Bronze Age had fled, but soon abandoned the chase because the 2 targets were too far away and had picked up too much speed. And thus Quantum and Bronze Age became the only survivors of the tremendous destruction. The droplet left the field of slaughter and set its heading in the direction of the sun. Apart from those 2 complete warships, a small number of people in the fleet had survived the Holocaust by boarding fighters or other small craft before the destruction of their ships. Although the droplet could have destroyed them effortlessly, it had no interest in small spacecraft. The biggest threat to these vessels, which lacked defensive systems and couldn't survive an impact, was from high-speed metal fragments, and some of them were destroyed by debris after leaving their mother ships. They had the greatest chance of survival at the beginning and the end of the attack, because at the start the metallic cloud had not yet formed, and by the end the cloud had grown far less dense as it expanded. The surviving small craft and fighters drifted for a few days beyond the orbit of Uranus and were eventually rescued by civilian spacecraft plying that region of space. The survivors numbered around 60,000 and included the 2 hibernator officers who had made the first correct assessment of the droplet's attack, Ensign Zhao Xin and Captain Li Wei. The region eventually became still, and the metallic cloud lost its luster in the coldness of the cosmos and disappeared into darkness. Over the years, and under the pull of the sun's gravity, the cloud stopped its expansion and began to lengthen, ultimately forming a long strip that turned into an extremely thin metallic belt around the sun, as if a million restless souls were floating endlessly in the cold outer reaches of the solar system. The destruction of the entirety of humanity's space force was accomplished by just 1 Trisolaran probe, and 9 like it were 3 years away from the solar system. The 10 of them together weren't even 1/10,000th the size of a single warship, and the Trisolaris had 1,000 of those that even now were flying onward toward the solar system. If I destroy you, what business is it of yours? Awakening from a long sleep, Zheng Beihai looked at the time. He had been asleep 15 hours, perhaps the longest he had ever slept apart from his 2 centuries in hibernation. Now he felt a new feeling. Examining his mind, he realized where this feeling came from. He was on his own. In the past, even when floating alone in the endlessness of space, he had never had the feeling of being on his own. His father's eyes were watching him from the beyond with a gaze that was present every moment of every day. Like the sunlight during daytime and the starlight at night, it had become a part of his world. Now his father's gaze had disappeared. "Time to go out," he said to himself as he adjusted his uniform. He had slept weightless, so no part of his hair or clothing was out of place. Taking a last look at the spherical cabin in which he had spent more than a month, he opened the door and drifted out, prepared to calmly face the fury of the crowd, to face the countless expressions of disdain and condemnation, to face the final judgment, and to face, as a conscientious soldier, a life whose duration he did not know. Whatever happened, the rest of his life was sure to be calm. The corridor was empty. He advanced slowly, passing compartments on either side, all of them open. They were all identical to his own spherical cabin, their snow-white walls resembling pupil-less eyes. The environment was clean, and he saw no open information windows. The ship's information system had probably been restarted and reformatted. He recalled a movie he had seen in his youth, in which the characters lived in a Rubik's Cube world made up of countless identical cubic rooms, each of which contained a different sort of death mechanism. They passed from one room to the next, endlessly. The free rein of his thoughts surprised him. This used to be a luxury, but now that his nearly 2-century-long mission was at an end, his mind could walk a leisurely path. He turned a corner, and ahead of him was another longer corridor that was just as empty. The bulkheads emitted an even, milky soft light that was enough to make him lose his sense of depth. The world felt compact. Again, the doors to the spherical cabins on either side were all open, and each one was an identical white space. Natural selection looked abandoned. To Zheng Beihai's eyes, the massive ship he occupied was one enormous yet concise symbol, a metaphor for some law hidden beneath reality. He had the illusion that these identical white spherical spaces extended endlessly into space around him, repeating infinitely through the universe. An idea popped into his mind. Holography. Every spherical cabin could achieve total manipulation and control of natural selection. So, at least from an informatics perspective, every cabin was the totality of natural selection. That meant natural selection was holographic. The ship itself was a metal seed carrying the total information of human civilization. If it germinated somewhere in the universe, then it might grow into a complete civilization. The part contained the whole, hence human civilization might be holographic as well. He had failed. He had not managed to spread these seeds, and for this he felt regret, but not sadness, and not just because he'd done everything he could to carry out his duty. His mind, now freed, took flight, and he imagined the universe as holographic, every point containing the whole, so that the entire universe endured so long as one atom remained. Suddenly, he had an all-encompassing sense of focus. the same feeling that Ding Yi had just over 10 hours ago at the other end of the solar system on the last stage of his approach toward the droplet, while Zheng Beihai was still asleep. He reached the end of the corridor and opened the door to enter the warship's largest spherical hall, the one he had arrived at when he first entered natural selection 3 months ago. As before, a formation of fleet officers and soldiers was floating in the centre of the sphere, but their numbers were several times greater and made up 3 layers in the formation. The 2,000-strong crew of natural selection formed the centre layer, which he realised was the only real layer. The other two were holograms. Looking closer, he saw that the hologram formations were made up of the officers and soldiers from the 4 pursuing ships. Right in the centre of the 3-layer formation was a row of 5 colonels, Dongfang Yangxu and the captains of the 4 other ships. All but Dongfang Yangxu were holograms that were evidently being transmitted from the pursuing ships. When he entered the hall, the eyes of 5,000 people focused on him with an expression clearly not directed at a defector. The captains saluted in order. Blue Space of the Asian Fleet, Enterprise of the North American Fleet, Deep Space of the Asian Fleet, Ultimate Law of the European Fleet. Dongfang Yanshu was the last to salute him. Natural Selection of the Asian Fleet. Sir, the 5 Stellar-class warships you have preserved for humanity are all that is left of Earth's space fleet. Please accept your command. It's a collapse. Everything's collapsed. It's collective mental breakdown. Shi Xiaoming sighed and shook his head. He had just returned from the underground city. The whole city's out of control. It's chaos. The administrative officials had all come to a meeting of the neighbourhood government. Hibernators made up 2/3, with modern people accounting for the rest. They were easily distinguishable now. Although they were in a state of extreme depression, the hibernator officials kept their composure despite their low spirits, while the moderns manifested signs of breakdown to varying degrees and lost control on multiple occasions during the course of the meeting. Shi Xiaoming's words plucked at their fragile nerves once again. The neighbourhood chief executive's eyes were wet with tears, and when he covered his face to weep, it prompted several other modern officials to weep with him. The official in charge of education laughed hysterically, and several other moderns began to snarl before tossing their cups on the ground.
"Quiet down," Shi Qiang said. His voice wasn't loud, but it had a dignity that quieted the modern officials. The executive and the others who were crying struggled to hold back their tears. "They're just kids," Hines said, shaking his head. Attending the meeting as a people's representative, he was perhaps the only person who had benefited from the destruction of the combined fleet, because now that reality was in line with his mental seal, he had returned to normal. Previously, he had been tormented day and night by the mental seal in the face of what seemed like an all but certain victory, and he had nearly suffered a mental breakdown. He had been sent to the largest hospital in the city, where expert psychiatrists had been powerless to help him, although they had proposed a novel idea, which Luo Ji and the suburban officials helped carry out. As in Daudet's The Siege of Berlin, or the old Golden Age film Goodbye Lenin, why not fabricate a fictional environment in which humanity had failed? Fortunately, at the pinnacle of modern virtual technology, it wasn't at all hard to create such an environment. Every day at his residence, Hines watched news that was broadcast especially for him, accompanied by lifelike 3-dimensional images. He saw a portion of the Trisolaran fleet accelerate and arrive at the solar system early, and humanity's combined fleets suffer heavy losses in a battle at the Kuiper Belt. Then the three fleets were unable to hold the line at Neptune's orbit, and they were forced to stage a difficult resistance at Jupiter's orbit. The neighbourhood official in charge of manufacturing this false world got quite wrapped up in it, and when the crushing defeat actually took place, he was the first to suffer a mental breakdown. He had exhausted his imagination painting humanity's defeat in the most disastrous way possible, both for Heinz's needs and for his own personal pleasure, but cruel reality far outstripped anything he had imagined. When the images of the fleet's destruction 20 AU away reached Earth after a 3-hour delay, the public behaved like a gang of desperate children, turning the world into a nightmare-plagued kindergarten. Mass mental breakdown spread rapidly, and everything went out of control. In Sher Chiang's neighbourhood, all the officials ranked higher than him either resigned or simply broke down and did nothing. So the higher-level authorities gave him an emergency appointment to take over the duties of the local chief executive. It may not have been all that important a post, but the fate of this hibernator neighbourhood was in his hands during this crisis. Fortunately, compared to the underground city, the hibernator societies remained relatively stable.
"I would ask everyone to remember the situation we're in," Sher Chiang said. "If there's ever a problem with the artificial environment system in the underground city, the place will turn to hell, and everyone there will flood out to the surface. If that happens, this place won't be fit for survival. We had better consider migration."
"Migration where?" someone asked.
"To somewhere sparsely populated, like the northwest. Of course, we would have to send people to check it out first. Right now, no one can say what will happen to the world or whether there will be another great ravine. We have to make preparations to survive totally on agriculture."
"Will the droplet attack Earth?" someone else asked.
"What's the point of fretting?" Sher Chiang shook his head. "No one can do anything about it at any rate. And until it punches through the Earth, we've still got to live, right?"
"That's right. Worrying is pointless. I'm quite clear on that point," Luo Ji said, breaking his silence.